Bridgebank helps breakthrough ideas actually break through and remains dedicated to providing financial solutions to the risk takers, the game changers, and the disruptors. Bridgebank, a division of Western Alliance Bank. Bridgebank, be bold, venture wisely.
Hey, it's Avery Truffleman, host of Articles of Interest, and I've got to say, I've been a fan of KQED ever since I was a little kid, and I would come out to San Francisco to visit my grandma. It was just what we'd always turn on every time we got in the car, every time we were making dinner and turning on the radio. It was always KQED. And then over the years, I've become a massive fan of KQED podcasts because this is local reporting at its best. These are answers to questions you've always wanted to know, interviews with exciting, unusual voices, necessary journalism, all told with love and care and artistry. And did you know that a majority of KQED's funding actually comes from members? It's just people like you and me supporting the programs they love, while also getting access to cool events, behind-the-scenes footage, and so much more. If you want to sign up and be a part of this amazing community, visit donate.kqed.org/podcasts to become a member today. That's podcasts with an S. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your support.
From KQED.
Something that I struggle with as a young adult is being misunderstood. My parents or adults in general always want to be right and never listen.
Imagine coming home, getting comfortable, trying to rest your brain from a long day at school until you hear your parents yelling about grades, upset about something you've been working as hard as you can on, but when you try to explain, they hit you with a, "You need to try harder." I'm not trying hard enough. Yeah. That's what I go through.
I'm Sasha Coca, and it's Youth Takeover Week here at KQED, where we produce the California Report magazine. That means all week long on KQED shows, we've been handing the mic over to high school students. This year, our show asked students at one high school in East Oakland to tell us about the challenges they feel they face on the cusp of young adulthood. These sophomores at Fremont High School told us resoundingly they feel misunderstood by the adults in their lives, including the ones they interact with at school. One of the frustrations we heard was that school officials and politicians don't understand how hurtful racist language can be. 16-year-old Serenity Dixon shared this audio essay with us.
Hi, my name is Serenity, and I wish politicians would talk about how non-Black students use the N-word. I feel like it's disrespectful, and you shouldn't use a word that you don't know the real meaning of, and like a word that you don't know the background about, because a lot of people use it because they grew up around the word and they think it's okay because of who they hang around. Like, they'll say, "I have Black friends, so I could use the N-word," but they don't know what it really means or like what it really meant. It's like too normalized, and I feel like it shouldn't be that way, and it don't even sound right when Black people use it. Like, we shouldn't use it, but I feel like it's more disrespectful when non-Black people use it, and they use it proudly and freely.
A lot of the students shared concerns that their parents don't really get what it's like to be a teenager.
I also feel misunderstood when it comes to school. My parents don't understand how overwhelming school can be. Parents and adults should listen and try to understand what a kid is trying to say.
As a teenager and an older sister, constantly being tasked with various responsibilities is not always simple. It leaves me with limited freedom, little time for me, and a few opportunities to socialize with friends. Instead, I find myself at home most of the time, fulfilling the task assigned by my parents. A few chores I have to do while being at home are cleaning the kitchen, living room dishes, and I also have to clean up for my brother.
I believe adults should start seeing the bigger picture of the modern generation's activities and see the good that it does for us kids.
That's 15-year-old Jorge Sainz. He brings us this audio essay about how his parents just don't get that video games might actually be good for kids.
When I was 10 years old, I loved gaming a lot. Video gaming. My biggest obstacle for playing games were my parents. Every time I played my game for longer than an hour, my mom would tell me to turn it off and get some activity in. I already played basketball at school every day. What more can I do? We learn a lot of things through gaming. We learn hand-eye coordination and how to communicate efficiently when collaborating with friends. It makes us kids smarter because we learn gaming IQ and what to do next during different situations. Gaming expands our minds and gives us different perspectives on life. One example of this is getting intrigued by different cultures and places through the internet and games. I say all this because I believe adults from past generations should look at the brighter side of things and try and actually understand what their kid is doing. Gaming will definitely leave knowledge in your head that varies from IQ to understanding the hidden meaning of anything. Now, I don't have that same spark I once had for gaming. I'm a full-time athlete. I box after school. I don't have as much time as I once did for gaming, but I can honestly say I gained a lot from it.
Other students talked about the toll the pressure to get good grades takes on them. Here's 16-year-old Saul Maravilla.
Do you care about your grades? You don't? Well, I do. Being an honor roll student seems like the greatest thing in the world, but it comes with its share of stress. Putting all your effort into something like it's your job can be pretty exhausting, but also rewarding in some ways. Obsessing over upholding the title of honor roll student for me is personally pretty unhealthy. It's like if you were to obsess over video games, but for me it's school. Even the smallest crack in my grades causes me to spiral over what I may be doing wrong. It's like once I get a B+ in a subject, I feel like I'm failing that class and that I'm doing terribly.
For some of the students, that pressure to get good grades can cause a major rift in their relationship with their parents. 16-year-old Jasmine Pitts wrote this letter to her mom about it.
Dear Mom, I'm not upset at you, but I want you to understand that I'm breaking my brain to get my grades in order, and I'm not like the other students who get on a roll. Trust me, I genuinely want to get on a roll, but I can't because I'm not like them. All I ever wanted was to make you proud of me. I haven't seen you proud of me since middle school. I'm trying. I will improve more. I will get past my fears and ask teachers for help when I need it. I just need my mom to believe in me and have patience with me. Hey, Mom, do you ever think about how I feel sometimes? Do you ever wonder if you're being too harsh on me? The hurtful things you say. Do you really mean that? Don't you think these grades are tearing us apart? You always tell me how your grades used to be back in high school and how you tried your best. I feel the same way, but I'm still getting yelled at for the things I've been working my best on. I love you, Mom, but will you ever understand how I feel? Love, Jasmine.
Other students shared how burdens outside of school can complicate their relationship with their parents. Clarissa Cardona Rodas says, having to take care of her four younger siblings gets in the way of her social life as a 16-year-old.
It's hard to find time to go out with my friends sometimes because there's always someone that I have to watch or take care of. Yeah, I'm an older sister, but that doesn't mean I have to always watch my siblings. I've been taking care of two kids since I was 8 years old. I've looked after them while my parents worked, and I still make food for them and clean up after them. It might not sound bad, but doing things like that from an early age did change me completely. I will always try to take care of someone else before myself. Even though my mom stays home now, I will always look out for my siblings. It feels like a big responsibility when my own mother tells me to tell my siblings to clean up after themselves. Sometimes I don't feel like an older sister. I feel more like a mother to my siblings. Mostly to my middle sister. And yet, even though I'm 16 years old, my sister doesn't respect me, which can get on my nerves. I know she doesn't listen to me because I'm not her mom, and that can lead to us fighting.
These students from Fremont High did have some ideas, though, about what parents can do to help support them.
I sit in front of screens and type all day. It's not much, and that's the problem. I get little physical stimulation besides during PE or outside of school. No physical activity means no mental activity. No mental activity means no dopamine or adrenaline. No happy chemicals means scrolling through my phone for hours to find something to entertain me. I deal with getting up super early and going to school. I run everywhere to help my family with the things they might need. I get home, carry groceries inside, clean after my pets, and clean my room. Sometimes all I want is a tiny break, but some of the adults around me claim I don't need one. When a kid needs a break, give the kid that break and talk to them about it.
I'm still 16. Let me live my teenage life and I'll take care of the rest. Honestly, I just need everyone to be patient. I'll try and get it done on my own.
Perspectives from sophomores in Mr. Leon Sykes' audio broadcasting class at Fremont High School in Oakland, talking about the challenges of being a young adult. We heard from
Clarissa Cardona Rodas,
Jasmine Pitts,
Jorge Sainz,
Danny Cepeda,
Serenity Dixon,
Melinda Gomez,
Amina Coins,
Toma Rivia.
A lot of the students we heard from as part of our Youth Takeover Week told us there aren't a lot of places in their lives where they feel they have control or power. Well, for our next story, we're going to head to the San Fernando Valley to meet some high school seniors who have taken over one of the most anticipated rites of passage, prom. Reporter Mariana Dale covers education for LAist. She discovered a program at Sylmar Charter High School where students don't just choose the theme and set up decorations for prom, they actually grow and arrange the flowers for the big event.
When I walk into Araceli Aguilar's classroom, the first thing I notice are giant fridges lining the back wall. They're filled with red roses, white carnations, and lavender.
Have you guys seen our daylilies? Do you think they're gonna pop open by Friday?
Yeah.
The students sit at long metal tables piled with flowers and tools.
In front of me, I have white spray roses with different size wires so we can use for the corsages.
That's senior Valeria Villalpaso. With prom just 3 days away, she and her classmates are working hard to finish the flowers that will fill the tables and complete their outfits.
I enjoy being able to get stuff like straight out of our own garden. It's pretty cool and it's more affordable too. We don't have to go to LA and get all the flowers.
Salvador Garcia is planning to use black tulle and purple ribbon for his boutonniere.
I just wanted to have creative freedom.
Students in Miss Araceli's class can also forage on campus, where hundreds of varieties of vegetables, flowers, fruit trees, and native plants grow. Jamie Hernandez leads me outside to pluck a few leaves off a towering shrub called Pittosporum, or mock orange.
I think this plant looks a little more, like, elegant.
She's using the green and white leaves for her dates boutonniere.
I'm going with my friend to prom.
You seemed a little like hesitant when you said friend.
It's just, I don't really know how to answer that.
That's okay. That's all right.
I remember the messiness of high school, so I decide not to pry any further. The agriculture program here dates to the school's opening in 1961. I visited a lot of school gardens as an education reporter, but I never heard of anything like this floriculture class.
Sometimes people say, oh, they're just flowers. I'm like, well, I mean, they're learning a lot through flowers.
Miss Araceli says the class blends science, sustainability, financial literacy, and creativity. Designing the floral arrangements for school dances is a tangible way for the students to show off their skills.
It's really their vision, and we're just trying to help them achieve it.
One of the first lessons of the school year is plant identification.
You know, what grows, I call it what grows in your hood.
The San Fernando Valley was an olive-producing powerhouse in the late 1800s and early 1900s. Tract homes and shopping centers have replaced most of the orchards, but the school has replanted olive trees on campus to honor this history. The class also builds on students' personal histories. Salvador Garcia and his family are from Durango, Mexico.
My grandma, she tended to have like a lot of plants too. Like she had a remedy. She would always, whenever she needed to make a tea or something, she would always send me outside and be like, get me this plant. It looks like this. So it's always been like in my life.
Salvador says floriculture class is a break from the stress of high school.
I'm learning about the flowers, and it's relaxing too. If you've ever like grabbed the flower, it's really relaxing to actually bond with them. And sometimes I catch myself like talking to them like, oh my gosh, you're perfect for what I'm doing.
It's finally prom night and it's raining, but the student centerpieces are safe inside. The lilies have opened into bright yellow stars.
Simple and elegant would was come to mind when I see these centerpieces that they created, and their vision comes to life here.
Miss Araceli greets the students as they walk in. They're eager to ditch their umbrellas and meet up with their friends.
Looking good. I like the suit. Looking sharp. Hi, hello.
Salvador arrives wearing a black suit and purple tie. His white rose boutonniere matches the ribbon laces in his Doc Marten Oxfords. He says regular dress shoes are too boring.
I feel like it brings my personality out, or it's like something that I think would describe me.
Some of the students are struggling to attach their boutonnieres to their jackets with long, sharp pins.
Did you need help with that, honey?
Yeah.
I was thinking.
Miss Araceli carefully pins the bloom Alexander Noriega made in her class to his chest.
I love the hands-on experience. It's really fun because I learned how to do this from Miss Araceli. And now it's just a skill that I know how to do for the rest of my life.
Alexander says he's also made bouquets for his friends and for his mom.
Well, when she picks me up and she sees me carrying a flower, I see her get excited, and it's the most precious thing I think I've ever seen.
Alexander signed up for Miss Araceli's class on a whim and was surprised by how much he enjoyed it.
And I hope you have fun tonight.
Thank you.
All right.
Now that his outfit is complete, Alexander is ready for one of high school's biggest nights.
That story came to us from LAist education reporter Mariana Dale in Somar.
How kids get to and from school is a big part of the school experience. But if you've been looking closely, you might have noticed there aren't as many school buses here in California as there are in other states. Katrina Schwartz, who's a producer with KQED's Bay Curious podcast, tried to figure out why that is. Hey there, Katrina.
Hey, Sasha.
So just how does California compare when it comes to school buses?
Well, nationwide, about 40% of kids ride a school bus, but here in California, only 8% ride a school bus. Those numbers come from the Federal Highway Administration. In fact, in the Bay Area, I had a fair amount of trouble finding any kid that rode a school bus until I started asking around in Berkeley, where it is a little bit more common for kids to ride a school bus than in some other cities. So I met up with Liz Cristiano at her house in Berkeley. She actually volunteered to let me come over at this very stressful time in the morning.
Good morning.
The getting ready time in order to meet up with her son James and his friend Eli as they were having breakfast and getting ready to go to the school bus. They are both fourth graders at John Muir Elementary, and they remember the first time that they rode the school bus.
It was kind of strange because, like, I didn't know anybody. But then, like, I got used to it really quickly.
It wasn't really scary. I guess it felt weird, I guess.
And they were not entirely positive about the experience, but kind of resigned to it, I would say.
It was really loud. There's, like, so many people talking at once. And then the bus driver, like, frequently stops or has to use the radio to tell people to be quiet or to stop using foul language on the bus.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's not always fun for kids to ride a school bus, but I can tell you that it would be a huge relief for me if my two kids could take a school bus and I did not have to drive them to and from school every day.
Totally. I mean, I think buses are really more for parents than they are for kids.
My morning would be ridiculously stressful if I had to take him, even though we're not that far away.
Liz Cristiano says she's not even sure how she'd manage her morning without the bus.
The getting up and going, having to manage all of the logistics of getting everywhere and everything on time is just, it's a lot.
She has another child who's younger, who goes to a preschool in Oakland. that school starts at the same time as James's school. So if she was having to take them both to school, it would be this real logistical hurdle to juggle it all. And so she was just very thankful for the bus.
Having your kid picked up and taken somewhere and then delivered home, the amount of life and cognitive space that you get back, I love it. I really love it. The mornings are so much better because of the bus.
James and Eli normally walk to the school bus together without their parents. It's about a 2-block walk. But this morning, because I was there, a bunch of kids met up and we all walked to the school bus together.
We're about to have to go to the bus.
Okay, let's go.
Get those shoes ready.
Do you want to interview me or Micah? They're also going to the bus.
So Micah, how do you feel about the bus?
I like that our parents still get to work as much as they want, and it's just fun to ride in the bus with friends.
What about you, Mia? How do you feel about it?
I really like it because even if you're late to the bus, all you have to do is run and he'll wait for you.
He waits for you?
Yeah.
And he laughs. He laughs the whole way.
Yeah.
This is my first year, so I was very nervous on the first day. I wasn't expecting that my stop would be the first stop on the whole thing and that it would take like 20 minutes to get to school.
Are you annoyed that it takes so long, or is it okay?
It's okay because then I get to talk to my friends when they get on the bus.
So is this the bus stop?
Yes.
It's a very sad bus stop because it has no sign.
And like, pretty soon the bus pulled up.
Oh, here it comes.
The kids all kind of gave their moms hugs and got on. And
what I'm trying to say is the bus is amazing. No, we are not. We are not.
Morning. Off they went.
I love that you were able to record those kids. They are so cute. And it sounds really great to be able to take the bus to school. Why can't every family in California just put their kid on a school bus?
Well, Sasha, like so many things related to school funding in California, this goes back to Proposition 13, which is a constitutional amendment that passed in 1978. And it really limits how much property taxes can increase for homeowners, which is a big deal for school districts because before Prop 13, property taxes were the main way that school districts funded themselves. Since then, that burden has shifted more to the state because of Prop 13.
The restriction of those sources of revenue in 1978 caused more or less a budget crisis.
I talked with Sam Speroni, who is a doctoral student at UCLA studying school transportation.
So in 1982, the state froze its home-to-school transportation budget with only cost-of-living adjustments. And that stayed in place until 2022.
So over the past 40-plus years, California's population has grown, though. So there's just this one pot of money that really hasn't changed that much, and more kids and more need. So if districts want to offer school buses, they have to kind of shoulder more of the burden to pay for that. And that means trade-offs. You know, you can't pay for everything.
That leads local districts into really difficult decisions about, do we continue providing buses or do we eliminate in-schoolhouse services that are also super important.
Reading support specialists, for example, or an extra social worker.
Well, and it sounds like Berkeley Unified is one place that is making a bigger investment compared to other school districts in California when it comes to school buses. Why is that?
So it goes back to the history of busing.
The method is busing, in itself one of the most controversial issues before boards of education throughout this country. But Berkeley is out to prove that it works.
You know, in the 1960s and 70s, school buses were one of the primary ways that districts tried to integrate their schools racially. There was a lot of segregation before that, and school busing was a way of basically moving kids around, mixing them up, taking them to different neighborhoods.
And with the use of 25 buses, 3,500 elementary children began the commute to and from white and Negro neighborhoods.
Trish McDermott is the senior communications director for Berkeley Unified, and she told me this history is fundamental to how Berkeley operates today.
In 1968, we integrated our elementary schools, and that really made Berkeley the first larger city in the country with a large minority enrollment to voluntarily desegregate schools, and we did that with our buses.
And Trish says even in progressive Berkeley, busing for integration wasn't always popular.
Big, crowded school board meetings, a lot of pushback.
They eventually got it done.
Oxford is typical of a school in Berkeley's white middle-class neighborhood. Last year, Oxford's student body had one Negro member. Today, 40% of the 325 students are Black.
It's a progressive district, and they care about creating schools that are diverse and integrated. So what they do is assign elementary school students to a zone, and then they look at the census for income data and parental education data to assign students to different schools. And then they use school buses to help kids and families get to the school that they were assigned to.
Okay, so Berkeley Unified is doing this, but we have almost 1,000 school districts here in California. What about the rest of the districts?
Well, it's important to know that there's no law in California that requires school districts to provide buses to general education students. So every district kind of looks at its budget and their student population and decides, you know, can we afford to do this or not? Is this where we want to spend our limited resources? You always have to make trade-offs. So in a rural district, for example, they often prioritize school transportation because the distances are longer, there maybe aren't any public transportation options for students, and the schools are more spread out. So busing is sort of essential to getting kids to school. I will say that every district does need to provide some school buses because they are federally mandated to transport certain groups of students to school. So if a student has transportation as part of their individualized education program, for example, maybe they have a disability or something like that, then they get transportation to school.
But a lot of families just don't have the option of a school bus, right? And so parents like me spend a lot of time, it can be hours out of our day, driving kids back and forth to school.
Yeah, and I mean, it's obviously not a great way to start the day or end the day, and the traffic at those times is usually the worst. But I guess, I don't know if this is cold comfort, but you are not alone in this. About 2/3 of California students get a ride to school in a private vehicle. And of course, if they live close enough to school, maybe they walk or bike to school, but I mean, the majority of kids in California are getting a ride, and that's a big ask for a lot of families, and it's bad for the environment.
And it's also an equity issue, right? I mean, some parents just don't have the luxury of having a car or the time in their workday to take their kids back and forth to school.
Yeah, so I think it really is an equity issue. And some districts are trying to mitigate that by partnering with public transportation systems. They offer subsidized fares or align the routes. But still, only about 2% of kids in California take a city bus or, you know, public transportation to school. But even knowing that, it's a little unclear exactly how much more access to public transportation would impact outcomes in school. But there are a lot of other factors that make schools unequal in California, so it's hard to say how much of a difference a school bus would really make to the whole big picture. One thing that experts I talked to said, though, is that if California as a state wants to even the playing field for families by offering choices about what schools a family might send their kid to, transportation really needs to be part of that conversation.
Katrina Schwartz is a producer with our sister podcast, Bay Curious. And that's it for the California Report magazine for this week. Our senior editor is Victoria Mauleon, with additional editing from Pauline Bartoloni and Olivia Allen Price. Susie Racho is our director-producer, with help this week from Jessica Carissa. Our sound engineer is Brendan Willard. Lucen Mendel is our intern. And I'm Sasha Coca. You can check out all of our California stories on our podcast, The California Report magazine. Your state, your stories.
Hey, it's Glenn Washington from Snap Judgment. And if you love what you're hearing, and I know you love what you're hearing, please consider becoming a KQED member. secret, special access to cool events, behind-the-scenes footage, and so much more. Plus, you'll sleep better at night, knowing you did your part for the community you depend upon. It's in you. Please be in it. Visit donate.kqed.org/podcasts to sign up now. That's podcast with an S. Thanks.